Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The president basically admitted to his crime. He actually talked about it on the news and said that he did, in fact, talk to the president of Ukraine and did, in fact, ask for help. There's nothing more impeachable than the president's own words.
President Trump was rightfully concerned about possible corrupt practices by Vice President Biden because it appeared that he was using his official office for personal family enrichment, and that is beyond the pale.
Arizona, you know, we're a relatively young state. People come from across the country and move there, combined with a very large Hispanic population. And, you know, I can see us going Democrat. I really can.
I've been involved in lawyer discipline since 1997. My partner was involved earlier than that. Neither of us are aware of a sitting Supreme Court justice having an active bar charge ever.
And with us to talk about the President Trump impeachment inquiry in the House and more stories of the week are Andre Cherney, former chair of the Arizona Democratic Party, and Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. How are you today, Steve?
Good to be back.
Very nice to see you both. Andre, let's start off with this impeachment inquiry. And Nancy Pelosi had sort of held back on it for quite a while, and now she's gone forward. How much of this actually is this phone conversation the president had with the president of Ukraine?
I think all of it is because of that. I think Nancy Pelosi, from a political standpoint, saw that this was at least a potential loser for Democrats, both in terms of the presidential election and also in terms of some of these competitive House seats. But when the evidence came out about this phone call and everything that it represented, really, even more importantly, it became something that was just indefensible. And it became fundamentally about what is the duty of somebody elected to the House of Representatives in this case. It's pretty much, as you heard in the montage before, the president admitted to what he did. And, you know, you read the first sentence of the whistleblower, of the whistleblower's official letter. In the course of my official duties, I have received information from multiple U.S. government officials that the President of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 U.S. election. This interference includes, among other things, pressuring a foreign country to investigate one of the president's main domestic political rivals. The president's personal lawyer, Mr. Giuliani, is a central figure in this effort. Attorney General Barr appears to be involved as well. That's the case.
Okay. Barrett, what do you make, first of all, the politics of this? The fact Nancy Pelosi wanted to hold off, and now here it comes.
You know, there is no doubt. I always thought that President Trump should have gotten President 101 during the transition to understand what to do and not do. But, you know, he steamrolls over everything. So he is certainly inartful and not following all the norms. But from a political standpoint, you know, we just saw finally Tom O'Halloran come out being pressured from the left to come out. In Arizona, I don't think this is nearly as nearly as popular as maybe other parts of California, New York, certainly the coast. But in Arizona, this is not as popular. And we see that in both the way cinema has handled it and the way that O'Halloran, who is truly in a competitive district. So politically speaking, it plays well in other parts of the country, but definitely not as well here in Arizona. So I think it's going to be interesting. You know, one of the problems I've had in this is Democrats decided to shoot first, aim later. You know, we've gone, you know, we're on board with this impeachment stuff. Well, I'd like to see some of these, you know, some of the information. I'd like to know what Rudy Giuliani did do or didn't do. Did he talk to the State Department? I mean, a lot of questions that are out there.
That's why we're having this inquiry, right? That's what Democrats are calling for. They're not saying, most part, let's impeach the guy. They're saying, Tom O'Halloran and others are saying, let's have an inquiry. This rises, I think you would hopefully agree, this rises to the level that the Congress of the United States should be having an inquiry to investigate what is going on here.
Many,
that's the question.
Many Democrats have actually come out pro-impeachment, not just pro-inquiry.
Yeah, there have been some who have said that based on already the evidence that's out there. And you know, to Baird's point, some of this is about being inartful. Some of this is just about the very, 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 very low bar that we give Donald Trump for anything that he does. But it goes beyond that. If this was just him getting on the phone and talking the way he talks to the president of Ukraine or some other foreign leader, help me out here, buddy. I need help. Okay. Bad, terrible, horrible, maybe not impeachable. The fact is, what was going on here was the president of the United States was holding back on military aid to an American ally under attack and holding that aid back until the president of the Ukraine agreed to play ball.
You know, and here's one of the consequences that isn't being talked about much, but I think eventually will become a big thing in the Democratic primary is what on earth was Hunter Biden being paid $50,000 a month, not a year, $50,000 a month. Andre, that's a good gig. I think even you will agree. What was he being paid that money for when Joe Biden was vice president? I think that does need – I'm not saying there's anything corrupt. I'm not saying it's illegal. I'm not saying any of that. But I do want to know, why was Hunter Biden, of all people, hired or put on the board of a Ukrainian gas company and paid $50,000 a month for?
Well, doesn't that introduce contradictions, though, and hypocrisy, which is the human condition, I suppose, that President Trump, with all the things that he has – it's almost weird. It's almost like, as Mark likes to say, Mr. Pot, kettle is calling. I mean, it's almost like he's the one who's pointing this out. That seems absurd to a lot of people.
I mean, we can ask those questions, but if we're going to ask questions about what is Donald Trump Jr. doing this is about painting everybody with the same broad brush and saying, all right, everybody's corrupt. That's not what's going on here. That's about fundamentally – that's the game that Donald Trump is playing, is let's throw something crazy out there. We don't know if anything's right or wrong, but he's getting paid $50,000. So there's really serious questions that need to be asked. That's not what's going on here. This is about the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief of the United States of America, withholding military aid in order to get a political favor done and pressuring a foreign leader to do so.
Yeah, I think that certainly can be looked at. I don't believe that there was this quid pro quo that everyone's talking about. Certainly, Donald Trump in that phone call says, do me a favor. You know, I know when I ask Steve to do me a favor, he never does it.
When Steve's country is under attack, he's the president of the country, and he's begging you for military weapons, that favor starts acting a little bit different.
Andre, let me ask you about – you mentioned that this issue in and of itself was reason for Speaker Pelosi to move forward. I'm wondering, from a public perception point of view, is this an easier sell to the American people for impeachment than Russia, collusion, any of the other things that some Democrats, especially in the House, have been calling for impeachment on?
I think it may be. You know, I think to Baird's point where I agree is I don't know where this is going to land politically. And I think, look, I had the fortune or misfortune of working in the White House 20-some years ago during the last impeachment. And I saw Republicans thinking this is a great political winner for us and rushing headlong into impeachment and we're going to bring down the president and all these things, and it completely backfired on them. Mm. I don't know where this is going to land. What I do know is this, more so than what happened with President Clinton, more so what happened even with Andrew Johnson 100, however many years ago, I'm not good at math, is something that is clearly, if true, and including the evidence the White House has put out, it looks like it's true, rises to the level of impeachable offense.
I will say the last week has been great for one reason, certainly. I haven't heard of Russia collusion. I haven't heard Mueller. I haven't heard, like, all the other things.
We have heard witch hunt, though.
Yes, we've heard witch hunt. But I haven't heard about all the other the little things that were being talked about that, were crammed down my throat on CNN, MSNBC, Fox. You know, we're not listening. We're not hearing any of that. We've now moved on. And that's the wonderful thing about the Trump era is if you're angry now, don't worry. You're going to forget about it by next week because there's something else to be angry about. And then the next week there'll be something else.
That is definitely looking at the bright side of dark state.
Barrett, at this point, are we too polarized? And I mean, actually, literally polarized in the political sense.
Absolutely.
To even make it for this to even be feel honest in any way on either side.
Absolutely, I will tell you, if you loved Trump 2 weeks ago, your opinion isn't changing. If you wanted him impeached 2 weeks ago, your opinion isn't changing. And if you know, the 3% of the country that's sitting on the fence, I don't know what would move you. I mean, we know everything, if you will. I mean, there's enough evidence out there that to hate him or love him. So I think that we are a very polarized country now, and we live in the post-truth era, of course. Nothing will change your mind. No matter the facts.
I agree with that 100%. And not just the polarization, but that post-truth era. I don't think anybody can realistically say that if this was President Obama saying we're going to withhold military aid to a country under attack unless you produce dirt about Mitt Romney's son, that those same Republicans would not be lining up to vote for impeachment and worse, but that's the era we live in.
It's an interesting point, Barrett. I've often wondered about sort of the other guy theory of this, where you know if a Democrat's upset about something the president's doing, how they would feel if President Obama did the same thing. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Republicans; they're upset about stuff that Obama did, or they're defending stuff that Trump does. How they would feel if Obama did the same thing? Are members of Congress that self-aware to think that way, or are they just sort of reacting to what's going to get them elected next?
Honestly, most members of Congress that I have ever come across, either in person or on TV, are not self-aware about anything. They believe that they are amazing. That is a very powerful thing. Well, if Barack Obama had – can you imagine if Barack Obama had done this? I mean, we hear that so often. And I hate that argument. I hate listening to that. And I always try to avoid it myself because we don't have to imagine, you know, look, this is the issue and let's deal with that. But we're going to just deal with it from our own. And by the way, you know, just think about like filibuster, you know, Democrats are opposed to ending the filibuster until they take power. Then they want to get rid of it. I mean, everything. There is always a tweet or an action 10 years ago from a Democrat that opposes what they're doing now. Same for Republicans.
The internet is forever.
Huh? And the internet is forever. You know, Joe Biden, supports something, but oh my God, 25 years ago, he gave a speech on the Senate floor of the exact opposite view. It's things change. People can change, and facts always change. And so, what happened 3 years ago, 2 years ago, it doesn't matter anymore. Let's just only focus on today and now.
That's Barrett Morrison. Also here is Andre Cherney with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We are in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are former State Democratic Party Chair Andre Cherney and Barrett Morrison of Morrison Media. Guys, before we move off the impeachment inquiry train, I'm really curious about something Jeff Flake said. And yes, I'm bringing up Jeff Flake. I know he's not in the Senate anymore. That he said in response to something that I think it was Mike Murphy, Republican consultant, said, if there was a secret ballot, 30 Republican senators would vote to impeach President Trump. Flake upped that to 35. Andre, what does that say to you? Did you think that's possible, actually?
I think that I was going to bring that up myself in reaction to what Barrett was saying before the break, which is, there's some people who are self-aware, not self-aware in politics. That's certainly true. There's people who believe what they're saying and believe what they're selling, rightly or wrongly. But I think there are people of conscience, if not courage, still left in the Republican Party. People who can say, we're not going to just dismiss something like this. This is actually wrong. This is not what the President of the United States is supposed to do. This is a dereliction of his office. The problem is they may believe that, but they're afraid of that next Republican primary and of the candidate who's going to come along and say, I'm a Donald Trump guy, and you abandon him, and Donald Trump starts tweeting mean things at them, and they fold like a cheap envelope.
You know, sometimes you have to ask yourself, do I want to be reelected more than do what I really feel? You know, during some of the debate, like on Obamacare, you know, and some Democrats were queasy about it because their district wouldn't support it. Well, you're a Democrat. This is the kind of thing you were, you know, you should believe in. And if you believe in it, then you should vote yes. Don't worry about your district. Now, some did, and they didn't worry about the district. They got defeated. But you know what? Sometimes you pay consequences for voting more with your heart than with your politics.
And look, I think, to be fair, that's what some of these Democrats who came out over the past week have done. These are people for whom, as Baird was saying, impeachment might be a political loser in their district. Their districts are not the places, wherever they are, Michigan and parts of California, Tom O'Halloran and folks like that, for whom this is going to be really complicated. But they saw, here's what's happening, and they stepped forward. And I think, frankly, it's time for Republicans of good faith to do the same. So far, one Republican who had to then leave the party took that kind of stance even before this. I think as this comes out, I still have optimism that there's going to be Republicans who are going to see this and say, this is where I'm getting off the train. And I've defended it thus far, but this is just a step too far.
Barrett, are there members of Congress, both Republican and Democrats, who are looking at the calendar, who are thinking, okay, so I'm up for a re-election in however many months, the inquiry will take this long. If there's a case in the House, it'll take this long. If it moves to the Senate, it'll take this long into getting into my campaign?
Yeah. Look, everyone's trying to figure out a calendar. But, I mean, look, again, the internet lives forever. We're always in campaign mode. Members of Congress, senators are always raising money. They're always thinking about November 9th or 8th, whatever.
Whatever that first Tuesday and
whatever that first Tuesday is next year. They're always looking to that. That's the most important date to them. So, most members, they don't control the calendar. They're just going to go with the flow and hope that it's either over very quickly or, you know, they get to avoid it altogether.
Guys, let's bring us back in state. And Barrett, let me start with you, having worked for state agencies as you have. Michael Traylor, DES director, is moving on to another position, and that leaves the current health director, Kara Crist, on an interim basis in charge of two agencies. What did you make of that? DES is such an important position. It's gone through a lot of things. We saw during the Brewer administration, there were a lot of bumps there.
Yeah.
How significant, first of all, what sort of position do you think that department is in now, and how important do you think the next leadership choice is going to be?
You know, there's been a lot of mishigas, as we Italians like to say, about Michael Traylor leaving. I think it's as interesting as watching artificial grass grow. Look, he's been there a couple of years. It's a difficult agency. There was a lot of talk because Chuck Ryan left Corrections. Look, I'll tell you, he'd been there since 1978. Mark, you were like, I don't know, still in diapers in 1978.
Thank you for bringing that up.
And I mean, that's a lifetime. How many of your listeners have been with an agency for 35 years? He was gone during the Napolitano years, so he was there for 35 years. You know, Michael Traylor was there, came in after a very difficult time. Tim Jeffries had just left after a lot of problems, we'll say, a lot of issues. And, he came in, he righted the agency. We haven't heard about a lot of scandal lately with that agency, a lot of issues. There are obviously the Hacienda stuff, did happen that time. But we haven't heard much of in the way of scandal or issues with this director. It's a lot to take on. It is the largest agency in the state. It's over $1 billion. It's a lot. You know, you're dealing with life and death. Sometimes that just wears on you. And when you're getting a little older, you're saying, hey, I'd like to slow it down a little bit. And, you know, Steve, as you well know, being a senior citizen yourself, sometimes you want to slow it down a little.
Andre, what do you make of this at this point?
It's a little bit mysterious. It was a sudden resignation, unclear exactly where he's going, what's happening. So I think there's more to this story than we know. What is true is this is a really important agency, and my hope is that Governor Ducey, who said he's going to be undertaking this nationwide search, finds somebody of real strength and caliber to come into this agency that is dealing with challenges like homelessness, which is rising across the state, challenges of resettling refugees, clearly a big challenge as well.
And that's something that he is now going to do through a different office,
governor's
some,
office,
some other, some
and,
other.
Right. So he's still in and came from the housing
undescript,
department.
Undescript yeah. office that that has
well, it's not,
not been.
A non-descript. It's an office at you know the governor's office of family, youth, and faith,
and something. Faith. Yeah.
Right. And so he's going to work on homelessness there,
which is great. But I think the point is, look, the, as you said, DS is where the rubber hits the road on those kinds of issues, and we really need a strong director who's really going to take that department and deal with some of the big challenges that have gone unaddressed.
Do either of you see any potential hiccups coming down the road for either the health department or DES? Kara Chris is going to be taking over DES on an interim basis while they find a new permanent director. But those are two really big, really important agencies that one person is basically going to be in charge of.
Right. Well, this will be on, obviously on an interim basis until the new one, new director comes on board. But I'll tell you, if you've ever spent time with Kara Chris, and I've only spent a little bit of time, she seems, you know, really on the ball, fascinating, and really sharp. So if someone's going to lead two agencies, I put a lot of faith in her.
Yeah, I, my hope is that the national search goes quickly and finds somebody who's really strong. We're in a place right now where we've seen a new report came out just yesterday, the largest amount of inequality in our country in terms of income ever seen, ever recorded. Those are some of the challenges that a place like DES is dealing with every single day. It's especially true in Arizona.
I'm curious about the aspect of, you guys have both talked about how difficult a job running DES is. Is there a pool of people out there who are really good at running such agencies?
Oh, sure. And thankfully, Arizona is a very attractive place. You know, once they took CPS, Child Protective Services, out of DES, it became a bit easier. You know, I mean, obviously, CPS was the origin of a lot of issues for that agency. Governor Brewer took it out, made it its own separate department in the state. So now it's truly focused on, you know, homelessness and social welfare agency. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there who would enjoy, who would like to, that challenge of ensuring that system works well. But it really tears you down after a while.
Coming back to the search aspect of it, in some ways, Governor Ducey's been unconventional. We mentioned Tim Jeffries, and I don't mean to bring that up in pejorative. He was an unconventional choice. We also had Greg McKay when he was DES was an unconventional choice based on his background. I mean, Audrey, when you talk about the challenges that this faces, the governor tends to be sort of someone who likes to pick people who can manage things and aren't necessarily super innovative. Is this a time to be innovative?
I think it is. We need to fundamentally relook at how we're dealing with some of these challenges. And so there's a lot of call for innovation. Let's also be frank. These are agencies that have been enormously underfunded, given the scale of the challenges we're facing. And so, yes, we need strong management. Yes, we need innovation. But if we're not going to be able to give these directors the budgets that they need to address these enormous challenges, then all the innovation and management in the world is not going to make a difference.
Barrett, do you think that Doug Ducey has made a call to Andy Tobin yet on this one?
I think this is the one office that Andy Tobin would not want to take over. It's a difficult agency, you know, corrections and DES.
Barrett, let me ask you about another big story this week. That is that the newest Arizona Supreme Court Justice, Bill Montgomery, Supreme Court has asked the independent counsel to take a look into an ethics complaint against him. How significant a decision is this, do you think?
Let me ask, Mark, do you know, can a Supreme Court justice without a law license continue to serve on the Supreme Court? That's a question I have. No, you know, I think this is a big deal. Now, one thing that is different, say, from the Andy Thomas independent counsel that we went through a few years ago is, you know, Bill Montgomery didn't actively do things that, you know, try to take people down and really hurt people. He's just accused of not really properly supervising Juan Martinez, you know, and withholding some public records. I don't think his outlook really is as bad as some people would like. Maybe he'll need some training on public records laws. But I don't think that it is a – I don't think at the end of the day he's got problems. I think Juan Martinez is going to have problems, but not Bill Montgomery himself.
And Barrett, finally then, Mark mentioned timing about people running for office. What about the fact that now Montgomery's already on the Supreme Court? I mean, ultimately, this is probably not going to lead to something that actually hurts his career.
I could disagree with you.
Oh, thank you.
You know, we have the system of retention here in Arizona. So he will be on the ballot in 2020. Now, people in Pima County don't know who he is, but I'll tell you, you know, if you remember just 3 years ago, a rich Democratic donor spent $1 million or $1.5 million, I don't remember the exact number, trying to defeat Bill Montgomery and came within 4 or 5 points. If that particular donor puts in $1.5 million in a statewide election and targets Pima County and Flagstaff and talks about how Bill Montgomery is against gay rights and things like that, he actually could in a ballot that no one votes on, or you know, an election that almost no one ever votes on, he could face some problems because he won't be able to necessarily raise the money to counter that argument.
Barry Morrison of Morrison Media, Andre Cherney, former chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Guys, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, thank you. It was great.
Arizona so far this year has tied its record high number of deaths from West Nile virus. 16 people have died of the disease this year, with more than 150 reported cases in the state. The vast majority of those cases have been in Maricopa County. With me to talk about why there have been so many cases is Jessica Rigler, an assistant director at the Arizona Department of Health Services. And Jessica, is it safe to say there are potentially more cases out there even than those that have been reported so far?
It is definitely likely that there are additional cases beyond those 156. West Nile virus is not symptomatic in the majority of people, so most people who get infected don't even know that they have the disease.
What is behind these increased numbers?
You know, it's really difficult to say why we're seeing so many additional cases of West Nile virus this year compared to previous years. We do know that when there's increases in mosquito activity, we can definitely see increases in West Nile virus disease and other mosquito-borne diseases. And some of that mosquito activity can be driven by weather patterns. So in years that you see more rain, which we certainly did earlier this year, you are likely to see increased mosquito activity.
It's interesting that you brought that up because I think for a lot of folks, they think of, you know, not leaving standing pools of water as a way to help decrease the mosquito population. And this summer, of course, saw very limited monsoon activity. But you're saying it goes back farther than that, having a wet winter as opposed to a wet summer as being a key here?
Yeah, in this case, actually, many of our cases were reported much earlier in the summer than now. And so even though we had a dry summer, we did have some increased mosquito activity a little bit earlier in our season, which we typically see from about May to October, the bulk of our West Nile virus cases.
Does that give any kind of indication as what the rest of the season might look like?
You know, our case counts have been slowing down a little bit. So there have been fewer people identified with West Nile virus in the recent weeks compared to earlier this summer. However, with some of the rains we've experienced lately and it still not being October yet, it's certainly possible we could see another small increase in cases.
You mentioned that West Nile can be sort of asymptomatic. Are you seeing a particular population of people who are reporting that they have been infected?
Yeah, unfortunately, the average age of our folks that have been infected this year are about 65. And we do generally see those symptomatic infections in older adults or those who have immunocompromising conditions.
So that's not terribly unusual then?
It's not, no.
Given that this summer was relatively dry, are you finding that the education campaign is maybe a little bit more of a tough sell this year? I mean, we always hear PSAs and see signs for, you know, don't leave puddles of water. Are people thinking about this as much as they normally do, given the lack of rain that we've had this summer?
Well, I hope in the recent weeks, people are definitely thinking about that since we've had rain just in the past few days. But there are other prevention methods as well. So we really want to encourage people to not go out around dawn and dusk when those mosquitoes are most active, or if they are out, that they use insect repellent or wear long sleeves or long pants. And those messages are good throughout the year, even when it hasn't been raining. Those self-protection messages are still very important.
Do you have a sense of how the numbers in Arizona compare to other states in terms of their numbers of West Nile virus cases this year?
Yeah, as we look at this year, Arizona has really had a banner year compared to the rest of the country for West Nile virus. So we're seeing much higher numbers of cases or rates of cases in Arizona than we're seeing around the country.
It wasn't that long ago that Arizona didn't really have West Nile virus. Safe to say that it's here for good now?
Yeah, you know, we had that big outbreak of West Nile virus back in 2003. That's what really kicked off a lot of the awareness about West Nile virus. And we've seen, you know, ebbing and flowing of the number of cases every year. In recent years, we've had pretty low numbers, but still cases identified, and then an increase as we've talked about this year. West Nile virus is here. It's in Arizona. It's something that people should anticipate every year. And that's why it's important for folks to remember those basic prevention messages that I think many people know already, to stay out away from mosquitoes at dusk and dawn and to really empty any of that standing water off of your property.
When you see ebbs and flows like that, I mean, is that largely weather related? I mean, are there other factors that determine whether or not it's a particularly difficult West Nile season here?
Yeah, you know, the ebbs and flows can be explained partially by weather. When we look at natural patterns of other diseases, we often will see them come in cycles. So, for example, whooping cough, we'll often see in five-year cycles where it peaks about every 5 years, or rabies has outbreak potential every couple of years is when we'll see rabies outbreaks. And so just in general, we expect through the natural course of disease, we'll see variations year over year in the number of cases.
All right. That's Jessica Rigler, an assistant director with the State Department of Health Services. Jessica, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hispanic consumers and business owners will continue to have an increasingly important role in Arizona's economy in the future, and the Hispanic population here will continue to grow. Arizona is now one of 9 states where the Hispanic population is greater than 1 million. It sits now at more than 2.2 million. That's more than triple the population was in 1990. Those are some of the key findings from the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce's 2019 Datos report on the state of Arizona's Hispanic market. To dig into this further, our co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with Monica Villalobos, president and CEO of the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. They began with the Latino population here, which is young and continues to grow. Lauren asked where it stands now.
What we know from our research is that the population now in Arizona is 2.2 million Hispanics. That's 30% of the state. We're also 40% of Phoenix Metro and more than 50% of our K-12 system.
So that says something about where we'll be in the future, right? And this report also highlights the fact that a lot of that Latino population in the state is sort of going to be aging into its prime investing, spending, buying years. So what does that mean in terms of this population's power as the state grows?
Right. We know that the median age of Hispanics is 26, which is at least a decade younger than other groups. And so that means more life stage changes. So things like buying a home, getting married, having a child, not always in that order, but for the most part, those life changes, which make them very good consumers, are critical times. And that's why the age issue is so important. It's a younger demographic that will be, quite frankly, supporting the older demographic.
So what does this mean in terms of, as we look at the state's future growth, especially economically, what does this mean in terms of buying power of the Latino population here, in terms of the other side, the factors driving the economy, businesses, et cetera?
We've seen an upward trajectory in terms of purchasing power for Hispanics in the state of Arizona. So now we're up near $50 billion that Latinos put into Arizona's economy. The most interesting thing is that during the economic downturn, which some would call a recession, we did not see a dip in purchasing power for Hispanics. It continued in that upward trajectory. So Latinos really contributed to sustaining the economy in Arizona during that difficult time.
So talking about entrepreneurs, Latino-owned businesses in the state, that continues to grow. I know this report shows that. But one sector in particular that's really interesting about that is the Latino women-owned businesses that have grown at even higher rates.
So what we saw is that between 2007 and 2015, there was a 2% growth in all businesses. However, for Hispanic businesses during that same time frame, there was a 70% growth. And for Hispanic women-owned businesses, it was 116% growth. Wow. And we're really seeing that women are coming into their own. They're maybe legitimizing home-based businesses. And they may not have considered themselves entrepreneurs or business owners, but now they're stepping up to the plate. We also know that until 1987, women required a man's signature on a business license in the United States. And so with that new freedom of being able to have a business license, we're now seeing kind of women's businesses hitting that peak and being able to start their own businesses without anyone's permission, if you will.
So the theme of this year's report was focused on health, right? Like in terms of what makes a healthy community. So this could be healthcare, but it also kind of highlights some of the disparities. Give us a sense of what that revealed this year.
So when you think about public health, you usually think about healthcare. But there are so many other things that impact. In fact, our research shows that only 10% of disease and illness can be attributed to genes and biology. The other 90% are things that we can control, behaviors, environment, all of those different things. So those elements, things like transportation, things like economic opportunity, housing, all of that contributes to our well-being. So what we found and what we really focused on this year was the difference between having health insurance and actually having access to good health care. And what our research found is that it's true, there are less Latinos that are uninsured. We saw an 11 percentage point decrease between 2013 and 2016 in Latinos that didn't have insurance. So that's a significant drop. We know they have insurance. However, most of that insurance is for catastrophic care. They're very high deductible plans. There are still other health costs that are associated with health care. So they still don't have that access that you would think comes with insurance. Getting insurance was solving half the problem. Mm-hmm. The other half comes from things like lifestyle changes. You know, one of the findings that we have is that 10% of Hispanics in the U.S. live in food deserts or are food insecure. That's a different conversation now. That's not just your health. It's access to fresh fruits and vegetables. The other piece is cultural barriers. I know my grandmother used to say, no voy al doctor porque me van a encontrar algo, which basically means I don't go to the doctor because they're going to find something wrong with me, right? So those cultural barriers really play a significant role in things like preventative care, treatment. So it was important for us to really kind of highlight those differences.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so big takeaways then. You do this report every year. I'm sure you see a lot of the same trends continue. But when we look toward the future of this state and the growing role that Latinos will play in it, what do you think we all should know?
You know, one of the biggest things with regard to business is the parity gap between minority and non-minority owned businesses. Right now, we know that Latino businesses are growing 3 to 4 times faster than other businesses. That's just the data. And that's true for minority businesses as a whole, not just Hispanic businesses. The problem is that their average annual revenue is about $110,000. Non-minority owned businesses are about $500,000 in annual revenue. That gap represents $36 billion that is not being actualized by the economy, right? Mm-hmm. That's not going into Arizona's economy. So what's going to happen in the future is we're going to have a lot of businesses, which is great because they're growing very, very fast horizontally, but they're all making very, very little money.
Right.
So that's why we're committed at the Arizona Hispanic Chamber to making sure they have the resources, the tools, the workshop, the information, the education to be able to scale their businesses.
All right. Monica Villalobos, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Monica Villalobos is the president and CEO of the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Theater companies around the country, including Arizona Theater Company, are increasing efforts to produce more diverse plays. Diversity means a number of things, from racial background to age to a range of ideas, in the attempt to serve a broader audience. As part of that, Arizona Theater Company has named the latest winner of its National Latinx Playwriting Award. It's Yale University master's candidate Benjamin Benet, who's being honored for his play Alma, and he's with me via Skype. Ben, how would you describe this particular play, and do you have a certain style, or are you still figuring this out as you become more experienced?
I think the voice is always shifting a little bit over time. But I would say that like the threads that connect all of my work are an interest in very intimate relationships between people. A lot of my plays tend to be very small in terms of the cast size. So this play, Alma, only has two characters. And I would say that's pretty typical of my work. A lot of the scenes that I tend to write are between two individuals because I think that allows the characters to really speak candidly. And we get a very intimate reflection of their relationship. I'm also really interested in expressionism and allowing sort of the interior internal landscape of a character to be manifested in some physical or exterior way so that the audience can get a sense visually, sensually, for what is the character feeling and what would the feeling, if we could take it out of their body, look like on stage. There's a moment in the play Alma where the title character becomes so overwhelmed emotionally that she screams. And in that moment of her screaming, the electricity in the apartment surges and results in a blackout. And I found that that is a thread through my work, that a lot of times I have imbued my characters with the power to shift the landscape and environment around them in some tangible way, but that also expresses something deeply personal and an emotional content that that character is holding.
So where did that become comfortable for you, or is that still a work in progress as well in terms of wanting things that would touch people and grab people in such a way? Certainly that's one of the things about live theater that so many people love, but unlike the electricity in the apartment, what courses through you when you feel like you've hit on something that really will strike an emotional chord with people?
Well, I think all of my work comes from a thread of the personal for myself. I usually won't write a story unless I have a way in to it personally in some capacity. So I think, and that feels really important to me because I think unless the story means something that is deeply resonant for myself, I won't ask that of an audience that they would have to sit through something unless I fully believed in it and felt like it deserved their attention. And I would say that's been true of myself as a writer all my life. I think the sort of autobiographical almost always finds its way into the work, sometimes in subtler ways.
So, Ben, theater, generally, as many aspects of art, whether it's galleries, museums, whatever it may be, are working hard and struggling, some would say, to get more people of a certain generation to be passionate about it, but be passionate also in a way that that sort of combines maybe the traditional with new ideas. As a young person, where do you see, in a larger general sense, the world of theater where it comes to maintaining some traditions, and I don't even mean well-known plays, I mean even just the way they're put about, how do you blend that with trying to get newer generations passionate about it and also recognizing diversity and current issues that are going on right now?
I think it is a great challenge for theater. I think one of the challenges is that theater as a medium moves really slowly in terms of its development. So for example, a play like Alma, I've been working on since 2016. And here we are a number of years later, and it's just beginning to break into sort of the national consciousness. The play still has not had an official world premiere. So, and I think that's pretty typical in terms of the timeline for plays. Many of them, I think, go through from an initial draft through a three-year development period before they even see a production. And our world is shifting so rapidly, especially in the current political landscape, that I think sort of relevant stories that feel really timely can become really outdated, even over the course of a three-year working period. I think that means that theater needs to really be forward-thinking. The medium will be looking to a younger generation that is sort of pushing boundaries, looking for stories that haven't been a part of the canon traditionally. And I think that means being more inclusive of voices that are queer, that are people of color, that are indigenous voices and perspectives that we just haven't been getting as part of the United States sort of national canon in theater traditionally. And I think we're still not seeing enough of it, even with some of the shifting that I think is going on with, I think, a consciousness around theaters being more equitable, more diverse, more inclusive. I think the shifts are still happening at such a small increment that I think it's going to have to move a lot faster in order to stay relevant to a younger audience.
Benjamin Benet is Arizona Theater Company's 2019 National Latinx Playwriting winner for his latest called Alma. Ben, very nice to talk with you. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Steve, it seems like it's finally starting to cool down a little bit.
Now, I know you have a green thumb, so this means you'll actually be able to keep some plants alive.
Could be a bit of a stretch. It's funny you mention that, though, because the Great American Seed Up is back, and to help local folks with a green thumb get their vegetable gardens back up and running.
Did you say Great American Seed Up? What is that?
Well, let the Urban Farms' Greg Peterson explain that.
I am fired up. Let's go. We are in for an epic event here. What we're doing in here is we have 60 different varieties of seeds, and people pretty soon are going to be coming in and scooping them up. It is an amazing way to invigorate your community with inexpensive seeds.
Well, Greg is jacked up about seeds.
How could he not be, Steve? The Seed Up is today and tomorrow at the North Phoenix Baptist Church, where you usually find the Uptown Farmers Market. This weekend, though, you'll also find bowls full of nearly 100 varieties of climate-appropriate seeds ready to be scooped up and planted, saved, or shared. And they'll all be available at a discounted bulk price.
Okay, I'm already getting ready for that nice, fresh produce you're going to bring me in a few months, right?
I'll have a salad for you, absolutely. They're definitely going to have some pretty special seeds for that to happen, for me to be actually able to grow them.
Well, you know this well. I always have faith in you.
That is kind of you. Don't hold your breath on that.
Well, I just don't want to squash your dreams.
Ugh, you really said that. All right, well, I see you that and tell you that we now let us move on from that.
Yes, thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.